I think I mentioned it beforehand, but there are some things that are not unique to moms and dads, but sometimes they're unique from the perspective. Tammy and I have put together a list of 4 difficult parenting situations, and they are not different for moms and dads. In other words, it'd be just as valuable for Tammy and I to stand up here and share that material with you. But Tammy can share with the ladies how they play a role and a part in that, and hopefully I'll share a little bit regarding you as dads, how you play it. So this is not to say that these are the biggest problems that anybody faces. I mentioned the family right now that's facing the loss of a child. That's a tough and has been for several years parenting situation. I know that there are problems, for example, with substance abuse. I know there's some other things, but these are 4 that we've identified that we consistently hear about. And I think for the most part, with the exception of 1 of the 3, every family currently has to engage these difficult situations. I mentioned the idea that parenting is a lot about first steps, and these present uncharted or at least unknown waters for us as parents. And so hopefully we can cast a little bit of light on those. First of all, is simply the role of communication in parenting. My father was a minister for more than 50 years. In other words, he was a communicator. My father was not shy. My father was very engaging. He could visit with anyone, was not intimidated, was not apprehensive to talking to people. My father and I had what I think was good conversation. I don't remember my dad and I ever having those Andy Griffith to Opie kind of sit-down conversations, but we had a good conversational style. But the communication aspect of fathering is super, super important. But some of those things are really difficult. When Tammy and I got married, by happenstance and a little bit of luck, I was not required to adopt my oldest son as my son to become my son. When Tammy had completed the birth certificate, she left the father's name blank. And that only required a change of paperwork for him to become legally my son, as opposed to an adoption program that requires everything from literally an ad in the newspaper, an announcement, a declaration of anyone who wants to stake claim and all that. All I had to do was pay a fee, and that became legal and binding, and Josh became my legal son. That's all well and good until Josh went to school, because at that point we had not yet put my name on the birth certificate, which meant Josh's legal name as he entered school was Josh Davison, not Josh Roberts. We had not had a conversation with Josh by the age of 6 about where he was at and what that history had been. He had known me since he was 2 months old and only knew me from 6 months on as his father. He really knew nothing else. But Tammy's aunt sat her down and said, "I want to encourage you to have a conversation with Josh, because we didn't with one of our children." Much later, when a family member at a family reunion blurted out something to the effect of, "Yeah, but he's not even your real dad," and they found out that way. And so Sandy told her, she says, "You need to sit down and have a conversation with Josh. And it probably will be more difficult for you than it is for him. And the reason why is most of what you're sharing is going to be beyond his comprehension. Don't try to explain everything that needs to be understood, but give him enough to satisfy him. And then in time, as he matures and other questions come along, you can answer more." Now, this conversation doesn't have to be in regards to adoption. It can be in regards to any number of things. I remember my aunt telling the story that she had her adopted son, and she sat him down and he was about five. And she said, we have, now he did know that he was adopted, but she sat down and wanted to explain to him about why they did what they did, and that he was not a second or an adoptive son, but like a real son to them. They loved him just as much as his older sister, all these kinds of things. And she said, I mean, he just was so engaged in listening. She says, I got all done, and I said, well, Scotty, do you have any questions whatsoever? And he goes, yeah. How come you have so much space in between your two front teeth? So all of that that she tried to share, whether it's about adoption, it's about the birds and the bees, it's about other difficult conversation, start with where they are. Keep a little bit in front of them, and then as they ask questions, be upfront, be honest, and talk with them. But for those of us who are talkers, we are faced with the biggest obstacle to communication, and that is we're typically not very good listeners. I mentioned it already in regards to being a good father, but good communication starts not with talking, but with listening. I would encourage you, whether you're a listener by nature or a talker by nature, that you perfect the art and the craft of listening. Engaging the person, your son or your daughter, with questions that allow them more opportunity to talk, not just the yes and no answers, not just the how is your day, fine. What was good about it? What was bad about it? What did you learn today? Nothing? Really, why do you think you didn't learn anything today? And take that conversation. It might be something significant. It might be something trivial. Now, my daughter is a talker. And when she went to high school the first year, I picked her up by way of schedule after work. I would come by and pick her up. And from the moment we left the school to the moment we get home, it was da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I would usually stop her somewhere. I said, do you feel like you're going to faint? And she goes, why? And I go, because you've taken no oxygen in. You've just kicked it out. And it was about everything. And it was the most, I said, wouldn't you like daddy just to lecture you from here to home? Because I'm good at that. But the listening required me to hush and to hear those particular things. Now, when you have those difficult conversations, maybe it's about friendships. Our oldest son had a friend when he was just going into what at that time was middle school for him, sixth and seventh grade. He was going into sixth grade, and or maybe a seventh and eighth grade. And in seventh grade, and the middle school, he found this friend. And Chet was from a broken home, and Chet wasn't by nature a bad kid, but he wasn't the greatest kid. And so we didn't have a problem with it, but we made the policy that, well, started seeing some things with Chet, and we told our oldest son, Josh, if you're going to hang out with Chet, it's going to need to be here at our house, just so we can kind of oversee this. You're still young. And then it got to a point with Chet that his behavior was such that, we just felt that it was best that that relationship be severed. And we had to tell Josh that. And if you can believe this, he didn't agree with us. So we had to have a conversation about it, and he didn't agree with us. Until sometime later when we were away from town on a Thanksgiving weekend visiting family in Oklahoma, someone broke into our home and stole some things. And then they called back to our number and left their voice on our answering machine. Hey, did somebody break into your house? Are you missing anything? Well, the problem was we recognized Chet's voice. And so did our son Josh. At which point in time he realized, I see what you were saying. It's unfortunate. Chet eventually died of a drug overdose. And I'm not saying that we saw it coming or that maybe there wasn't something more we could have done. I wish there was, but it was finally then clear. In other words, those are difficult conversations, or conversations about the use of alcohol, or perhaps discovering that they have been engaged in viewing pornography or some other behavior that you know is not just unacceptable, but it is not good for you. The tendency is going to be in those situations to peg, to react rather than to respond. Whether it's the I told you so or I can't believe you did that, I want to encourage you to do something that I did not do very well when my kids were growing up. And that is to be overreactionary. Tammy's father is a really patient man. He is not quiet. It's just that when he speaks, you're like, man, he has thought about this, and this is well said, and there's great wisdom behind it. He's not what you would call a talker. Her mother can be a little, or at least early on in our marriage, could be a little curt. She spoke when she shouldn't have spoke, and she was at times a little harsh. It wasn't until later that we had found out about her upbringing. Her mother had died. Her father had married again. The second wife forbid him from hugging and being affectionate with his natural children, but to be affectionate with her children and their children together. At 7, she was in the cotton fields picking cotton. She had had a lot of things in her life that had made her just very standoffish. So when Tammy discovered that she was pregnant, she knew you can't hide this for long, or at least much more than about 5 or 6 months. And so she had to go into her father and mother and tell them, I'm pregnant. You can only imagine how you knew that they'd be disappointed. They'd find perhaps you a disgrace. And she said, I told my dad. And she said, surprisingly, my dad couldn't say anything. It wasn't until later that he came back. And she said, at first I thought, how can my loving, caring dad not say anything? But the truth was, he was not one to be reactionary. He was quiet for a little bit. She says, but then I had to tell my mom, and I know how my mom was, or at least how I thought she was. She was so caring, so loving, only to reveal to me that her older brother, and Tammy says, I knew this, but I didn't know the circumstances, was born out of wedlock to a man that had run off. And she said, she spoke to me and she was understanding and caring and compassionate. And she said, I needed that. It is hard to do that. Because after you've instructed and after you've warned and corrected and even after you've punished, when your children bring some of those things to your mind, you're going to find yourself going, this was really, really tough. It was so much so that Tammy said she realized that with our kids, she needed to be a little more clear regarding not just the birds and the bees, but how to keep things in their hive until it's time, right? So, if you can imagine this, whenever one of our boys began to get serious with a girl, Tammy took them on a date. I felt for my sons, I felt for those girls, because Tammy took them, she bought them dinner, and she had a conversation with them about those things. I will just tell you that daughter-in-laws that I have now that married those sons, I think they only managed because they endured that conversation with Tammy. Because the others went, man, this family is nothing for me. So when working through those conversations, be very, very careful that you continue to be conversational, not confrontational. Okay? Number 2, electronics. Now, I'm older than most of the guys in the room here, but I will just say, for those of you who are older or older thinking, our personal electronics and technology as we know it is not just here to stay. It is here to stay and to grow and to grow and to grow. There is no place in parenting for the, well, not at my house, because the world of technology is present. It is hard to believe, my numbers may be off a little bit, I don't think that the iPhone is more than 15 years old. I think it's 13, 14. Pandemic threw my internal clock way off. I lost a year and a half in there. But it's about 15 years old, and whoever's looking it up right now, on their iPhone, go ahead and read it out to me because I want to know how long it is. But imagine what we have seen in technology in 10 or 15 years, right? Not just the cellular phone, but the iPhone, the watch, the tablets, the computers the way they are, it's revolutionary and it shows no sign of being anything but continuing to grow. However, at the same time, I don't want you to be naive about this thing. If you are a father who taught your kids about how to handle, for example, a gun, you are a sportsman, you know the value of it even for not just game, but for maybe even protection, but you recognize that it is not something to be dealt with flippantly. I don't want to sound some kind of a sky is falling alarm, but this thing is an incredibly powerful tool and it can be incredibly dangerous at the same time. And so when it comes to electronics, here are just a few things that I want to suggest to you. Number one is, don't be naive in thinking it won't happen to my kid. And for that matter, it won't happen to my spouse or it won't happen to me. This device has given us grander access. I shouldn't say grand. It has given us greater access to more things than we have ever had access for. And not all of that is good to access. And so, don't be naive. Place some boundaries. It's interesting that Steve Jobs, at least the idea man behind the iPod and then eventually the iPhone, forbid the iPhone to come to his family dinner table. Whether it was his family directly or it was guests, there was a basket that sat in the adjacent room and all phones had to go into that basket prior to dinner. Simply a boundary that was set. Set boundaries. Find appropriate applications that will tell you, for example, my son that lives in Denver, he has four kids, two of them have iPhones, and he is able to limit their screen time. He's able to limit their screen time through the application. In fact, sometimes they'll come in and they look like they're on the, you know, they're on the parole board trying to get out early. They're begging for more time for their phone. He knows where they are, where they have been, and he can look at their phone at any point in time and know what they have accessed. He is capable of, or he limits them in all of those capabilities and lets them recognize that that's the way it's going to be. But he doesn't just limit it on their phone. For example, they can't go to their own room privately and be on their electronic devices. Now, let me just tell you right now, there is not a 6th, 7th, 8th grader that's going to tell you that's a great idea. They're going to hate it. But that's where your wisdom and your experience comes into play. Don't be unreasonable. Don't ground anybody the rest of their life. You don't have that power. But to say, listen, these locations, this time of day, these applications, this is where we're going to limit you. We do that with speed limits in cars. We do that with the prescription on the back of medications. Those are not unreasonable things. They are the things that give us the safest operation of this powerful device. Be mindful of those things. There is another problem with devices, and simply put, the fact is the more connected we are electronically, it is being proven over and over, the more disconnected we are socially. We're disconnected because we no longer have to go to somebody and tell them they're a no good, dirty, rotten scoundrel. We can just text it. We can just post it. And no risk of getting poked in the nose over it. The best we can do is poke back and we'll delete it. I mean, that's just the way it is. My son, Jeremy Roberts, has written a book called Disconnect. It is not about how to unplug from electronics. It is how to, as parents, look at rebuilding relationships and personal value in light of a world of electronics. It's available through Gospel Advocate. I'd highly recommend it, not because it's my son's, but because nobody else that I know of in Lord's Church has written such a book, and it'd be a valuable resource to you. But the more that electronics exist, the more there is going to need for a relationship within the family and with those who are outside the family. And so I'd work on those. Third difficult situation. It is the thing that we don't talk about in church buildings because it's dirty, or at least we act like it is, and that's sex. It's interesting how much God talks about sex in Scripture, and he doesn't always talk about it bad, but the only time we ever typically talk about it is in the bad. I'll give you an illustration of that. That has to do with reminding young men and young women as they are entering those areas of puberty and those days in which they begin to find an attraction and an affection for the opposite sex, that we begin something like this. Now, you don't want to do this, and you don't want to do this, and you don't want to do this. And we leave in the mind of many of those young men and young women that it is a terrible thing, which we're saving for marriage. And so what we want to do is we want to have a more God-driven view of it that we communicate to our children. Number one, that sex is a natural thing. Sex in and of itself is not wrong. And though it is disciplined, it is, as I just said regarding technology, with anything that is very powerful, it requires a degree of discipline for it to be enjoyed to its fullest. You need to understand not only that it is natural and normal, but that it is a beautiful thing. One of the biggest things that we have perhaps as a society done is we've made even the word sex have a degree of dirty about it. And we want to take the X out of sex, if you will, and begin to show that it is God's design, that it is beautiful, and that it is fully fulfilled in marriage, where our children are not apprehensive to talk to us about that thing. My parents gave me a book. I wished I still had it. I can buy it, and I'm not going to waste the $6 because it wasn't worth the $6. Though I think my mother probably paid $3 for it. It was called For Boys Only, and it had a companion book. You want to guess what it was called? For Girls Only. All I want to do is get a copy of that For Girls Only and find out what they knew that we didn't know. But it had some things about general hygiene and about how boys work and how boys girl and girls work and how boys and girls work, but how they shouldn't quite work yet, okay? So that was the book was all about, and it was a doctor answering questions of young men. And I don't know if you've ever been in a group of young men, when they ask questions, they're asking dumb questions, not the right questions. So the book was full of a lot of questions that nobody was asking. But nevertheless, it didn't have any pictures, so it didn't help at all. So anyway, that was the way that it was. But it was a conscientious effort on the part of my parents to say, we need to have this conversation. And I would suggest you not talk about the birds and the bees, because birds and bees don't do it the way that humans do it. It'd be good to talk about boys and girls and those things. Start younger rather than older. I remember offering a sermon series on the Song of Solomon. It was very tastefully done. It was very age appropriate, but one of the members was very concerned. Brought it up in the business meeting. We didn't have elders at the time. Brought it up in the business meeting. Don't you think this would be better served to be like on a Wednesday night class somewhere else in the building rather than the auditorium? To which one of our aged members, who had been an elder before and a minister, he said, if you don't think that your sixth grader, which is where his son was at that time, has not already heard about this, you're fooling yourself. We're finding younger and younger, and technology is certainly contributing to it, but our culture is doing their part too, to tell our kids younger and younger about what sex is, and that's not what sex is. That is what the world is telling them. You don't have to feed them the entire basket of stuff, but you need to be able to. Now, whether or not you want to have code names for body parts, that's up to you. There's nothing, I don't know, the only thing creepier is a kid that has weird names for body parts or the four-year-old that knows all the biological names. That seems creepy to me as well. I kind of said, let's not let our kids know that there are any biological names so that when they raise their hand in seventh grade biology class and ask a question, everybody will go, what'd you just call that? You know, that was just a practical joke. But there is a place to decide. We need to start talking a little bit about these things. Sexuality impacts us in a couple different ways, three that I can think of. Number one, it has to do with our attraction. That's becoming under fire a little bit these days, what I'm attracted to. It has to do with our expression of sexuality and our identification of sexuality. And I don't mean to lump those all in one big basket, because they are each and of themselves very different. But here's some things. There is a world right now that is confusing young men and young women, and here's how they're confusing them. They're confusing them by convincing them that their identity is found in their so-called orientation, that their identity is found in their appearance, that their identity is found in all these things. Sexuality is not our value. It is not what should show our value. And so when it doesn't become as much of a new expression of me, it is able to keep it a little more the way that God designed it to be. But when sexual identity or our sexual expression in our appearance gets us the attention that we are lacking, it will become an important thing. In other words, it's not about our attraction, it's about being attractive to the world that is around us. I want to find a way to fit in. And so it is important not to devalue us, but to value us for something other than our sexuality. When it comes to expression, and I would say this to a parent who had a son or daughter that quote-unquote identified as heterosexual, or one that said that they felt that they were attracted to the opposite sex. Whatever attraction you feel, God always says there's a limitation on it. Be angry, but do not sin. Be angry, but don't commit murder. That's not saying that everything about your feeling isn't valid. It's just saying that God puts limits. For example, a young man, a young woman, who we would consider to have a natural God-given affinity for one another, they are still required to show some self-discipline in regards to that. Someone who has a feeling of anger is still to show self-control and not act upon that anger in a way that would be sinful. And so we can have these individuals over here, and we sometimes argue the wrong point, and that may be how you feel. I can't tell you how you feel. In fact, I can't even tell you how you should feel, because it's clear that you feel this way. But what I can say is that God's put some limitations on that. No matter how you feel, it cannot be expressed, or it cannot be expressed in the way that you wish to express it. Does that make some sense? I'm not trying to affirm it. What I'm saying is that the place to begin is, I feel angry. Okay, but you can't hit your sister, right? But I'm jealous, I know, but you can't then steal as a result of that. Yeah, but I have this affection for this woman. Okay, but you can't act on that until marriage. Well, I have this feeling for someone of the same sex. Okay, but you can't act on that, because God has said those actions are wrong. And so that's a good place to begin with, not you don't feel that way, but you can't always express your feelings the way that you want to. Otherwise, we would in fact have true chaos. I want to again mention the idea about don't be reactionary. This might come if I or better taken if I explain a way that Tammy said. She had a young woman that came to her and said, "My friend tells me that she thinks she's gay. How should I respond?" No, I take that back. Her question was, "What Bible verse can I give her in response to that?" And Tammy said, "I wouldn't start with a Bible verse." She said, "I would start this way. That must be extremely tough for you. Have you told your parents about this? I'm so humbled that you would share this with me. Would you like me to go with your parents so that you can tell them what you're struggling with?" Now, it could be that in some people's mind, well, you haven't told her that she's wrong. I would guess that she knows there's something about that that's not right, but she's still struggling with it. So the showing of compassion, whether it is for someone who is outside your family or someone who's inside your family that makes those kinds of statements, that you begin by having a conversation, because as soon as you close the door on that conversation, your influence in the situation is over. It's really hard because where does patience end and tolerance begin? I don't know that because I think situations are different. But it is to say, what makes you feel this way? When did you start feeling this way? How does it make you feel? For example, a young man says, well, I recognized this way back when I was in PE class. Way back in PE class, I remember my gym teacher, and he was a man. We began to unpack it just a little bit. We find out some things like, well, guess what? I had a gym teacher. He was a really short guy. He was Japanese, Mr. Miyamoto. Mr. Miyamoto was very well built, and I had, listen carefully, lest you misquote me, I had an attraction to Mr. Miyamoto. He was a small guy, but he was an athletic guy. I found him engaging. I wanted to talk to him, but guess what? A world confuses me sometimes by saying, oh, you know what that means? You're this or you're that. Attraction is what builds our friendships. Attraction is what builds those partnerships. Attraction, of course, can lead with sexuality. It just so happened that when I was a student at Oklahoma Christian University, I had a professor, a Bible professor, who asked me if I would go with him to a small town about 30 minutes outside of Oklahoma City on Sundays, and I could teach class and he would preach. It wasn't until a year later when he, along with 8 Oklahoma Christian students, were all sent from the campus. It turned out he was grooming me, sexually speaking. Never knew it. He never made an overture towards me in all of that. I like theater. I like Broadway musicals. I'm a guy that likes creativity and design. Tammy wants, as I said before, she wants a Harley Davidson. I have a lot of things about me that if I listen to a world, they'll go, well, you know what that means, don't you? You're a little, and I don't mean this really disrespectful, you're a little light in the loafers. You're a little inclined towards that. Why is it that you think he picked you out? Maybe it's because you are gay. I ain't. I got 4 kids to prove it, and they all act just like me. My point is this. The world is defining the things that are happening and telling them that this means that when in fact it doesn't. But if you shut them out and don't have that conversation about it, you're going to leave the defining to the world. We have friends right now, 2 different families that are dealing with this very same, very kind of thing when they're, both of them, one has a son and one has a daughter that thinks they're just the opposite. And I have not found a nice, simple, easy answer to it. Try to say, remain firm in what you believe. You can't let sin happen. You have to be willing to be and show compassionate and some patience. And I'll be willing to say, I'll meet you halfway if they'll meet you halfway. Typically, they don't want to meet halfway. They just want everybody to come to their side. But say, okay, let's come together and have a conversation. Much more we could say about that, but I got one more I want to talk about really fast. The lady's going to probably come in here. A few years ago, I had the unfortunate honor of being asked to speak about prodigal children. The reason why is because my oldest and my youngest are currently away from the Lord, and I did not like that honor. I'd rather speak on how to raise godly children, right? Because they feared that I knew something about it. But there's a couple of things about prodigals, and as we get older, we're hearing more and more from older couples that are saying, our kids, they went to church, we thought we raised them right, and now they don't have anything to do with church. And I'm not here to analyze all the whys that might have happened. I have some things that I suppose some things we were responsible for, some things that we weren't responsible for. For example, God was a perfect father who had 2 children at one point in time, and both of them became prodigals, right? Adam and Eve. And that wasn't a God fault, that was an Adam and Eve problem. And so don't blame everything on it, but here's a couple of things. 1, do whatever you can to prevent a prodigal. In other words, don't just say, well, you know, not much we can do about it. They're going to make their own choices. No, through your instruction, through your training, through your discipline, use whatever efforts you can to avoid it. Trust me, preventing the problem is a lot better than trying to correct the problem. 2, we've already mentioned this, and that's put trust in God. If you think you're going to bring back your prodigal on your own, you are mistaken. In fact, not only trusting in God will help with your prodigal, but it relieves your burden of trying to do it all by yourself, because you'll find very quickly that you can't. 3, surround yourself with good, positive people. people. Now, you'll find lots of counselors, but not always very much counsel. Everybody has an opinion regarding your prodigal, but try to find those people, and I believe they're God's people, that have the same love for your child that you have for them, and they have the same love for God as you have for him, and let them be the one that surround you and you support you. Number four, you're going to want to quit. And by the way, with us, with our first situation, I wanted to quit everything. I didn't want to be a parent anymore. I didn't really want to be a husband anymore. I didn't want to go to work. I didn't want to do anything. I was like, you mean for 20-some years we've done all of this and this is what's happening now? I don't care. And that's when the devil goes, it worked, right? Find yourself getting back to work, doing more things. It is a great distraction, the more of those things you can do from that problem that you face, and it will fill your spirit. As I said, don't try to figure out why. Even if you figured out why, you can't undo the why. You can only talk about what goes on from here. In fact, frequently Tammy and I would say, well, here's what we did today. I'm not completely sure if it was the right thing or the wrong thing. It's just the thing that we did, and tomorrow we're going to work to do better. That's the best that you can hope for, is doing better than you did today. You can't make up for those things. You can't correct those things. You can only work from here forward. And then simply to understand that you can't let their choice destroy you. I think you need to prepare yourself for their return. Interesting enough, the story of the prodigal son is not the story of the prodigal son at all. The story of the prodigal son is the unforgiving brother story. He's the story. He's us. We like to be the prodigal. Oh, we were the prodigal and God wanted us back. Nope. We'd like to be the father. Oh, I'm waiting for my prodigal return. We're not. We're the unforgiving brother. And so we want to prepare ourselves for their return. And at the same time, and this is the most painful lesson I ever have to teach, and you have to prepare yourself for the fact that they may not return. That's really hard. But even some of God's own people chose not to return to him no matter what he did. That doesn't give you comfort, but I think it can give you peace in saying at the end of things, God is the righteous judge who will never, never, never judge unrighteously. And now that means he will be hard on the wicked. It also means, though, that he knows who are his and he can do for them what he can't do. When my oldest son lived with us, I could make sure every night that he was in the house and that he was safe and he was secure. When he moved out, though we saw him on a regular basis, I didn't tuck him in every night. I went to sleep not knowing if he was in for the night, if he was safe, if he had food in his bed. I didn't know any of that stuff. There was more that I could do for him inside my house. And so for your children, especially those that at one time were followers of Jesus and belonged to him, remember he can do more for his children who belong to him than he can for those who are outside, and find some comfort in that. Conversation, electronics, sexuality, prodigal. Could we have had more things? Yeah, could we say more about that? Yes. But you, along with your spouse and with God's help, can work your way through those things.